Recently, I was speaking at a church in the process of expanding its central leadership group. They wanted to add elders, and they wanted me to weigh in. They had already had 5 weeks of study based on Alexander Strauch's book, Biblical Eldership, which I believe is one of the best. I warned them that I might depart from their own church's tradition. How much do you want me to share? They said, well, you have 35 minutes. That includes the Q&A. I'm sure whatever you do will be fine. And I was very happy to give this lesson. And there was such a buzz after, and I guess kind of a buzz in my head too. I thought, this might make a podcast. This might make something that would be interesting to some of my website members. And so let's take a fresh look at elders. I'd like to do this just for the sake of simplicity and time. I'd like to do it from Acts and 1 Timothy. We will spend a little bit of time on Ephesians 4:11 at the end, but there's so many eldership passages. I'll refer to some, but the only ones we'll read will be in Acts and 1 Timothy, plus a single verse in Ephesians. The early church seems to have been very intentional about establishing local leadership. The church is planted. Acts 13, the eldership is established. Acts 14. Now, just as an aside, I know it's always dangerous with an aside, may get us off our topic entirely, but when they planted churches, I noticed this just recently in the book of Acts, they didn't transplant churches. That is, they weren't so much taking members from one city and planting them in another city, although I think that's fine. And in effect, that's what the Holy Spirit did after the persecution of Acts chapter 8. Look at Acts 8:4, Acts 11:19. You'll see that. But the deliberate church planting strategy is a little different. It's a couple of preachers. I would say that they're evangelists functionally. They go to a town. They take advantage of their opportunities or create the opportunities, and a church is formed out of the new converts. And eventually they go on. But the point is to establish leadership locally. In Acts 13, where we see, it's really the first time we see intentional church planting in the New Testament, we read this. Now there were in the church at Antioch prophets and teachers, and they name five of them. While they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Spirit said, set apart for me two of them for the work to which I've called them. They prayed, they fasted, laid hands, and sent them off. Well, of course, this is Saul and Barnabas, and they go to Cyprus, and this is the first missionary journey. They come back, I think, as soon as they can, and we read this near the end of Acts chapter 14. When they had appointed elders. Actually, let me back up just a tiny bit. They strengthen the souls of the disciples. They encourage everyone to remain true to the faith. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church with prayer and fasting, which connects it in with Acts 13, they committed them to the Lord in whom they had believed. So they planted the church in a city. They come back within months. Could it have been a year? I mean, it can't have been that long. And then elders are appointed. This is team leadership. Team leadership. Now, I'm not someone who would oppose one-man lead in the very early stages of a church. That is, if you moved to a certain city and you started a church, you would very naturally be a kind of father. You know, Paul describes himself that way to the Corinthians, or in his personal relationships with Titus or Timothy. And we need to be grateful to our leaders, to those who led us to the Lord, to those who planted congregations. That's great. But if the church has been around for a while, not just a few months, maybe it's years or decades, and there's no functioning team leadership, a group of overseers, then I would say something is wrong. It's not just that I believe we should follow the biblical pattern. It's that I think there's wisdom in the way these church planters in the book of Acts did it. And this would mean that a protracted, autocratic church polity, you know, a one-man lead that's dragging on and on. That's not envisioned biblically, and I don't think it's healthy for the church or for the man or the couple who are taking all that on themselves. This does not mean that there is complete independence. Congregational autonomy simply means that the buck stops with that congregation and with its leadership. After they went through the cities where they had preached and appointed elders, those congregations knew who its designated leaders were. Now, I would guess, though I cannot prove it, I would guess that the overseers were overseers of house churches. People met where they could meet, they met in homes, and that would make a lot of sense of the requirement that the family be under control. You know, if Junior is having a tantrum in one room, or there's tension in the air, the household isn't getting on very well, you know, that kind of negativity, that would make it very hard to have a church. At any rate, we know the early church met in homes. There's lots of evidence in the New Testament. So imagine that the overseer, the elder, is one who leads one of these groups. Personal ministry, that's an important thing. If so, the congregation knows its leaders. I mean, maybe one house church doesn't know everyone in another house church, but it's probable, in fact, I would say it's certain, that they knew the leaders of their own congregation. They're shepherds. They're personally involved. And so congregational autonomy doesn't mean isolation. We see in the very next chapter in Acts 15, when there's an issue, people get together. Overseers come together from different places. They cooperate. And so it's a very healthy kind of interaction. Now, when Paul gives his farewell address to the Ephesian leaders, although I'm not so sure he didn't meet them again, but it's a farewell address when he gives it. That's in Acts chapter 20. Who does he call? He's in nearby Miletus. It's a really cool town, by the way. Who does he ask for? He calls for the elders. Now, certainly, there are many ways we can serve. When you hear the word elder, do you just think of a man with gray hair who's very balanced and calm and good as a counselor, but not a great speaker, not a powerful leader? If so, I would say you've been affected by a certain tradition. I'm not sure that that's biblical. Paul calls for the ones he needs to address because of an impending crisis. Well, whether it was happening immediately or in several years, he knew that wolves would grow up from within their own number, actually the number of the leaders themselves, and he wants to prepare them. It's a very impassioned address that he gives them in Acts 20. Who does he call for? I mean, we don't have apostles today, but if an apostle were passing near Atlanta, let's say he was going 2 hours away, two hours, Chattanooga, Tennessee. And because of a concern in Atlanta, he was asking to meet with the most influential leaders in Atlanta. There are certain men I cannot imagine him not inviting. He would certainly want to talk to the most influential, those who were maybe directing the affairs of the church. Let's think about that. That's in the book of Acts. Now we go to 1 Timothy. In chapter 5 of 1 Timothy, we read about some elders who direct the affairs of the church. Now, does that mean that some directed the affairs and others didn't? He actually said, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor or double pay. The Greek is the same word, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. So in the past, I thought, well, maybe some elders focused more on preaching and teaching, and maybe others were more doing administration. It's really hard to make a hard and fast distinction here. I mean, if you're doing really well in preaching and teaching, by the way, that's exactly what Timothy in the previous chapter was called to do, to read the word, to preach, and to teach. So the elders who were his best successors, let's say, the ones who were doing what needed to be done, and this is the reason that Paul reminds Timothy to keep the standard high. If they do well, they're worthy of double honor, or perhaps double pay. Think about that. Elders directing the church, ruling the church. Now, before you say, oh, Douglas is against every other leadership position. He doesn't want preachers, or some people call them pastors. he doesn't want evangelists or any kind of director. That's simply not true. In fact, every congregation has some kind of a leadership group. There's always some kind of a group. Now, if it's dominated by one person, then that's more of autocracy. That's not healthy, as I've said. But there's always a group. Whether you officially have elders or not, whoever the overseers are, whoever's directing the church, they are that group. That's the group that Paul would have sent for, to meet him in Miletus, so to speak. It's interesting to me that when Paul writes to the Philippians, he mentions the congregation and the elders, the overseers, actually, and then also the deacons who were particularly ministering to the poor. This is an incredibly important position in the early church. Why is it that some congregations have existed for years but have no elders? Often it's said, well, we just don't have anyone who meets up to the qualifications. What qualifications? Well, in chapter 3, and I'll read this passage. The saying is trustworthy, if anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach. Not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle. Not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace and into a snare of the devil. This is not so much a list of qualifications, it's a list of qualities, and the focus is on character. It's not charisma so much as character. And I would definitely like to challenge any culture that says, well, the ones who have charisma, they need to be addressing the church and inspiring and motivating. The people with character, well, they better, they better be the elders. Or as I've heard it put, the preacher, he brings them in the front door, and the elder, he stops them going out the back door. I don't think there's any way you can support this biblically. Any biblical leader is a shepherd. The question is, what kind of a shepherd are you? Ezekiel 34 is the classic chapter on that. Anyway, it's about character. Paul assumes that the overseers will be husbands and fathers. Now, what's not so clear is that he requires them to be. This is not to deny that a man's family reflects his character and his leadership ability. It does. It's a kind of mirror. But would Paul have been disqualified? Could Timothy have been an elder? I mean, the one who's going around, I know he was a younger man. Timothy's probably only in his 30s or maybe 40 at this time. Paul is probably in his 60s. But was Paul disqualified? Could Jesus not be an overseer? That doesn't really make sense. Paul assumes that these men will be married because most men do go that way. He assumes they'll have children because most men do. But he never explicitly says they can't serve unless they have a family. And he never says that they can't serve if they're single. I know some people might like to debate that. That's really a matter of interpretation, though. It seems to me, at any rate, hypocritical to hold overseers to a higher standard of integrity than church leaders. Now, a lot of people today in the evangelical world especially like the word pastor. Pastor is a word that doesn't even appear in the Bible. It's a Latin word. It's only retained in Ephesians 4 out of tradition. It should be translated shepherd. That word poimen in Greek is translated shepherd everywhere. That's what it means. At any rate, the preacher, if you call him a preacher or a minister or evangelist, these are just titles. But to hold him, with all of his influence, to a lower standard than we would hold the overseers to, the elders, seems to me quite hypocritical. The one who has the greater influence is held to a higher standard. Isn't that what we see in James chapter 3? I mean, not too many should presume to teach, to influence others, because they're going to be judged more strictly. Those who have the greatest influence are held to the highest standard. Those who have less influence are held to a lesser standard. I would also add, it seems very unhealthy to put the spotlight on children. So many people look at Titus 1:6, it's just a single verse in the entire Bible, and they interpret it the strictest way possible. Instead of the focus being on the man, the leader, it's on the children. And in that passage, commentators are divided. Some say it's saying that the children must be believers. Others say they must be trustworthy or obedient to their father. The Greek word is the word faithful, which can go either way. About half the times in the New Testament, it means believing, but just over half the times in the New Testament, it means trustworthy. But even if you do take it strictly, very strictly, we have to be careful. Grammatically, it never says that a man has to have all of his children as Christians. The emphasis seems to be on those in his home, and that's taking it the most strict way possible. I'm fine with taking it strictly, but the point is, throughout the Bible, it's the shepherds who are held to the high standard. It's not their children who should be judged, it's them. And it's those who have the greatest influence to whom these qualities are these list of qualities apply the most. I could put it this way. The list in 1 Timothy 3 is really just a comprehensive description of a mature male Christian leader. I mean, that's what we all want to be like. Have a good reputation with outsiders. Not a new convert. And what does that mean? Well, it's dangerous. It's unfair to the man. It's unfair to the church. He's able to keep his household in order. He doesn't love money. That's especially relevant if they were paid at the time. He's able to teach because elders teach and preach. And he is a one-woman man. He's faithful to his wife. It assumes he has a wife. If he doesn't, he would have to be a man of the highest integrity. And in fact, I thought about 1 Timothy 3, and I wondered if there might be a similar passage about women. Well, yeah, there is a passage about the wife of the servant, the wife of the deacon, just following. But I thought of the Old Testament, Proverbs 31, the Proverbs 31 woman, who is in some sense super mom. I mean, she's up early, she stays up late, she runs a home business, everyone is doing well. She knows, you know, in the streets, everyone welcomes her. Her children rise up and call her blessed and so forth. She embodies all the ideals, all the respected qualities of a spiritual woman, and she's worthy of full respect. Now, does that mean that a lesser woman isn't worthy of full respect? Are you somehow second rate if you don't embody all those qualities, or if you don't make your own clothes or run your own business? In a way, it's an idealized picture. Could it be that 1 Timothy 3 is similar? It's saying, well, this is kind of the perfect leader. This is the mature male Christian leader. We want those qualities in everyone, of course, and we all want to be perfect too. We want to see those qualities in the oversight group. I mean, our oversight group in Atlanta is an interesting group. All kinds of people. We have several preachers. We have several who've lived in other countries. We have shrewd businessmen. Several of the people are on staff. We have people gifted in worship and administration, all different. And we all have weaknesses and strengths. Together, combined, it's a strong group. If everyone had to embody every quality, well, we'd be in real trouble, I think. It's group leadership. And you'd say, now, wait a minute, Douglas, are you saying you have 9 elders, 10 elders. Well, I don't really care what you call it. This is the oversight group. These are the overseers. Some of them have been officially recognized as elders, and that's great. But who is doing the overseeing? Those are the overseers, right? It's about function more than title. At any rate, 1 Timothy 3 puts the spotlight on the character of the leader. But it doesn't say that he's disqualified if on a single area, in a single area, he's somewhat weak. That is, you know, if he's, well, he's three quarters as good a preacher as the other guy. Well, he's not violent, but he is somewhat opinionated. Oh, sorry, we can't have him. Well, he has 9 children eight of them are Christians, one isn't, so he has to step down or whatever. I've heard some wacky things said. Surely Paul is trying to guide us. The Spirit is guiding us into the kind of person we should have, having a great reputation with outsiders. Well, we all want to have a great reputation with outsiders. It's dangerous to the church if the overseer doesn't. But we have different levels of reputation. It gets somewhat subjective when you're trying to measure this. Does this make sense? I hope so. These are just my thoughts. I'm not speaking for one group. In fact, I don't know many people who think exactly like I do. I'm just trying to figure out what the Bible's saying. Okay, we have one more passage. And that's the verse in Ephesians 4. You know it. Paul is talking about the gifts. When Christ ascended, he gave various gifts to the church. All of these gifts involve building people up, particularly through the word. These are speaking positions. Let me read in the English Standard Version. He gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ. Now, I think it's four positions. Some people know me as a teacher more than anything else, and you'd say, wait a minute, you're undermining your own position. Well, you can be a teacher whether it's an official position or not. I mean, in Antioch, there were prophets and teachers. Well, what was Paul? Was he a prophet or was he a teacher? Or was he both? Are we talking about functions or titles? The passage says that Christ gave apostles, prophets, evangelists, and shepherds and teachers, or maybe teaching shepherds. I think that's a somewhat more natural way of reading it in the Greek. Either way, there are four or five positions there. What do those mean? Well, the apostles were few in number. They persisted for a single generation. They were eyewitnesses of the risen Christ. Their purpose was to establish the church, living links to the Lord Jesus, so that his message was understood and preserved. Most congregations did not have an apostle, and probably most congregations in the second generation had never been visited by an apostle, never seen one. Prophets, whatever the exact nature of their work, they were also at the very foundational level of the church. Look in Ephesians 2:20. And this is certainly not talking about Old Testament prophets. It's the New Testament prophets. It seems to be that whatever they did was miraculous. It's not normative. That is, we don't read that every church has prophets. The closest you get is Paul's words of goodwill to the Corinthians. Then you come to the evangelists, who seem to be highly mobile bringers of good news. They established churches. They were dynamos of inspiration, evangelism, and leadership. We only have a few passages, though. In fact, only two others. Timothy, who's told to fulfill his ministry, and then Philip, whether he's evangelist emeritus or not is not clear. But in Acts 21, we read about him, the one who had the four daughters who prophesied. Well, there's always a need for evangelists. There always will be. These are men of faith who interface with the community, bring the gospel where it's not been heard. But oddly enough, they're not explicitly identified in church history. And I've read just about everything written in the second and third century. There's no mention of them. The churches have elders. And even when a hierarchy begins to grow, it's the deacon, the servant, ends up becoming more like an assistant to the elder. The elder eventually turns into a priest, and the chief elder is named the bishop, and then the high bishop becomes an archbishop and so forth. But even in the second century, when hierarchy is growing, the churches are led by overseers, no evangelists. In time, a very elaborate hierarchy was erected, but it didn't include the preachers. And maybe there's a reason for that. It may be that the evangelists were so mobile, they're always on the move, or typically on the move, that their position in the local church was only temporary. Those who would be leading in time, and this explains Paul's urgency to appoint them in Acts 14, his words to Titus in Titus 1 concerning Crete, the quality control effort or emphasis that he entrusts Timothy with in 1 Timothy chapter 3. All this would be explained if that's the normative position. Oh, let me keep going. Teachers. Now, again, I'm not sure that there was a particular position called teachers, and we should all strive to be teachers. But even if there is, I'm not sure they're in every congregation. If they are, you'd have apostles, prophets, and teachers everywhere. Paul says these are three of the most important gifts in 1 Corinthians 12:28. What does this leave us with? Well, the evidence of the New Testament is that teachers, evangelists, prophets, apostles are kind of here and there. But the goal was for elders, that is, overseers or shepherds, these terms are used interchangeably, the goal to be to have them everywhere. This is normative. In fact, it's the only position of the four or five leadership roles Paul mentions that's normative for church leadership. And the earliest centuries of church history consistently follow this pattern. And let me summarize. What's the pattern? Churches are planted, Acts 13. Group leadership is established, Acts 14. They're not independent. They're not isolated. They still interact as they did in the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15. When there's a crisis, when something important needs to be taken care of, it's the overseers who are sent for, Acts 20. These are mature Christians. There is a picture of the ideal elder in 1 Timothy. I shared my opinion, some of them somewhat strong, particularly my disappointment that such a high standard would be applied to men who are serving more as a board or a kind of a committee who just keep an eye on things, but not to those who have the greatest influence. To me, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Elders were no rubber stamp, no mere committee, not just there to look good or to support the program of the real leaders. Elders directed the affairs of the church. They were preaching. They were teaching. That's what I see in the New Testament. What do you see? What are the implications? I pray you'll think about that long and hard and realize, of course, the important thing is not what we call things, it's what we do. It's much more important to have team leadership than to have all the right terminology, though that's helpful as well. It's much more important that we hold those with the greatest influence to the highest standard and that we not separate, making artificial distinctions, separating out man-made, artificial interpretations of qualities for different kinds of leaders. Let's just stick with the Bible. I hope you found this interesting. Hope you found it as stimulating as I have. Thanks for listening.